The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Steve Cantor. He is CEO of S2K Financial, where he is responsible for overseeing the strategic direction of the firm. And he's also CEO of S2K Partners, the lead investor in S2K Financial, which is a New York City-based alternative investment firm dedicated to providing capital and strategic solutions to middle market companies and funds. Steve Cantor has more than 30 years of investing and investment banking experience, and he has raised billions of dollars for REITs and other real estate companies via IPOs, CMBS financings, and other forms of equity and debt financing. He is former executive managing director and global head of investment banking at Cantor Fitzgerald, as well as chairman and co-founder of CCRE, Cantor Fitzgerald's affiliated commercial real estate lending platform. Prior to that, he was managing director at Credit Suisse, where he held several senior titles. He's also a graduate of Syracuse University. So go Orangemen, Jim Boeheim and the Orangemen. And growing up in Endicott, New York, I'm quite the Syracuse fan. He also got his degree in jurisprudence from American University. He joins us today by telephone to discuss the future of investment product development. Steve Cantor, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. And by the way, I didn't know you were a Syracuse boy.
Endicott.
That's close enough for me. What you left out there is our colors of our firm are orange.
That's right.
So we bleed orange here.
That's right. There you go. Well, it's transferable. You know, once an Orangeman, always an Orangeman.
Absolutely.
And Endicott, New York doesn't have. We have Binghamton University there, but it's just not big time college basketball or football. So I had to be a Syracuse fan for sure. So, but at any rate, we're also a fan of great investment products, Steve. And, you know, you were, I saw you on the panel. There was a panel at the recent ADESA conference in Las Vegas, moderated by our very own CEO, Jeff Dorman. And you were very vocal, very emphatic about certain points, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this program. But also Jennifer Dorman-Alper, who is my colleague here at the magazine, saw you talk about the future of investment product development. And said it was very good. And based on those two things, I thought good idea to have you on the program. And that's really where I want to take that first question. You know, what do you consider, what's wrong with product development today? Obviously, there's good products. I'm sure that you put your good housekeeping seal of approval on some of them. But what do you consider to be some of the weaknesses of the current approach by sponsors to product development?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, and I have been vocal. This world didn't need somebody else to get into this business. I always say if you can't do something a little differently, there's no reason to be in the business. We kind of going backwards, we kind of stepped into this business because we had a client that was actually looking to sell product into this channel, the independent channel. And it's an exciting channel. You know, I don't know if people know this, but the channel was raising about $20 billion a year in product. $20 billion with an average ticket size of $30,000 and about 15% of the independent broker-dealers selling the product. That's an amazing number. I always come from the institutional world where I didn't even actually understand this world existed. And so I went and looked at the product, and you know, the problem with the product is I didn't see how investors could make money. Now, if it was 08, 09, and we were down at the bottom of a cycle, and you can improve something by 50%, yes, investors can make money. But in any given rational time, I didn't know how they could make money. And what I mean by that is I didn't know how you could pay a 12% commission upfront load, as they call it, pay 2% in acquisition fee, and then pay dividends that you didn't earn of another 2% until you got assets. So if you gave me a dollar, only about 82 cents was going in the ground. I didn't know at 82 cents in the ground how you can get some of their money back plus what you promised them most of the time is 6% dividend. I thought that was a problem. And, you know, I always believe that I don't know a lot, but I do believe I feel a lot better if I could find a way that, A, works mathematically. But B, if people are going to make those claims, they should put their money where their mouth is. So to me, how do you create product that has an alignment of interest? And then you'd see how people felt about putting 82 cents in the ground, sponsors. And so we start to look at the space and say we need to align the interest and make the structures of these deals better. So very simple investing. You should give the investor a fair shot of actually making money and getting their money back. So, you know, this is pretty simple. What does an investor want? He wants the dividend you promised him. He wants it paid on time. And at some point, when you promised him, he wants his money back. And then I like to call it, he likes a kiss. Whatever you promise somebody, if you can outperform that, they're very happy. So how do you create a structure? And how do you create alignment of interests so that the investor can actually have that shot?
So what are the ramifications then of these products, investment products, that where they're overcharging? Basically, you're saying that they're overcharging the investor when they put their money into these programs. What are the ramifications? Has it been, well, I'll leave it at that. What do you consider to be the ramifications of that?
Well, I you know, it's funny. I don't think they're overcharging. I think that's really the key, right? I think if you look at the, you know, who got paid at that 12%, I think people could have earned that. I think it's being paid by the wrong person. So if this was the institutional world, those costs are picked up by the sponsor of the product, not the investor. So I don't believe people are overcharging. I believe that the sponsor should pick up that cost, not the investor.
Well, but isn't that overcharging because the investor's paying for it?
Well, I want to be very clear. It's not. I'm not saying that they didn't earn their 12% along the way, all the people in the middle. I am saying that I just want the sponsor to pay it, not the investor. I believe the investor is being overcharged because they shouldn't pay it at all. It should be paid by the investor. You know, if it was 1% or 2%, I kind of get it. But when you're taking 12%, really when you're done 16 to 18% out, and that's being borne by the investor, I don't think you've taken much of a risk as a sponsor.
So let's talk about some of these new regulations. What do new regulations that have been implemented and or proposed tell you about what needs to happen around product development and new investment products? Because this is part of what the regulators have been up in arms about, that investors, there's fees that are either not being made transparent or that they're just fees that are quite steep. So what about the new regulations?
Well, there's multiple regulations, and let's kind of look through the problems. Some are regulatory and some are not, right? In the regulatory world, I separate Rule 1502, which at the end of the day said you've got to be transparent about what the assets are worth. So in the old days, I sold you something for $10, I took 16 to 18% out, and your statement read $10. Not anymore. You got to be transparent. If it says $10, it better be worth $10. And, you know, what happened was when 1502 came into effect a little over a year ago, the reality of this was people woke up thinking they had $10 on their statements, and they woke up and said, oh, my God, why is this worth $8.80? Now, it was all disclosed in a 400-page prospectus, but the reality was they thought they had $10. And so it has hurt people who woke up and said, look, I don't know about you, but when I get my statement every month, if it went up a penny, I probably don't look at it. If it went down a penny, I'm all over my broker about what happened. Well, could you imagine if you woke up one day and you thought you had $10 and now it's at $8.80 for that investment? And that was a great regulatory change. I believe it. Transparency is the key to everything. So that was amazing. The second one, which is, you know, is sitting around, no one's really sure where it's going to come out, whatever is DOL, Department of Labor. And that's a tougher one. You know, I think a lot of brokers think that DOL, the fiduciary obligation to a broker or a brokerage firm, means suitability, and it doesn't. Suitability is part of it. I think there's going to have to be justifications for everything of why you put people in the products you put them in. And I think it's really hard to explain to a client as a fiduciary why you would put something in down 14 to 16% or even 18%, and then have to explain why there were other products potentially that were out there that you don't have to. And, oh, by the way, how do you explain that you paid 14 to 16 or 18% and you promised with 6 when on the back of an envelope, you can't make that work? So I think DOL is going to have to make people look a second time, from firms to due diligence offices to brokers, and saying, would I put my mother in that investment? Does that make sense? And I really think that throughout that my mom would want to invest in that. And I always say, if you can't meet the mom test, you got a problem. So I think those regulatory issues are great. The last one, and I want to go back to transparency for a second, is the way these other deals worked, not only did they charge us 14 to 18% at the end of the day, but they all had also had a lot of fees. So you paid a an asset management fee, you paid a property management fee, you paid a financing fee, and I could keep going. They feed the hell out of this thing. And the reality was they promised you liquidity at 5 to 7 years, and you know why you never got liquidity? Because the 15% you gave the sponsor as a back end after you got your money back plus the six wasn't worth anything. So you know what he does? He keeps the fees. And therefore, the biggest issue that has nothing to do with the regulatory is the lack of liquidity in products that you were promised liquidity in. You might be sitting in these products forever without liquidity. And once again, it's because you didn't make the incentives fit the sponsor. Pavlov's dog. I don't remember a lot about school, but I remember Pavlov's dog, which is if you give people the right incentive, they usually do the right thing. So I think those are your big issues, both regulatory and non-regulatory.
Okay, so investors aren't salivating the way they should be, but or maybe they are salivating, but they're not getting the reward. The bell dings, they salivate. There's no chow at the end of the line there. Give us an example, though, when you say of a product, and I don't mean a specific product. We don't want to tar anybody right now, but when you say that they're promised liquidity and they don't get liquidity, give me the scenario.
What happens here is when you buy these deals, people always ask the question is, when can I expect liquidity? You know, these are private funds. And people said, well, I'm going to invest the money over the next 2 or 3 years, and then I'm going to run the assets for 5 years. And then at some point, I'm going to sell the assets to get your money back. Because remember, these are non-traded. There is no liquidity unless I sell assets.
Oh, you're talking about a liquidity event then. I see what you're saying.
Yep, okay. All liquidity. Yep. Okay. And so you got to get that liquidity event. There's no other way to get your money back. Well, why would I give you a liquidity event if my only incentive is to collect fees?
Exactly. Okay, now let me ask you this. And this really is about the panel that you were on at Adiza, which was the institutionalization of private wealth. And institutional players like Blackstone and Brookfield and TH Real Estate are moving into the private wealth space. Let's talk about how that's going to change product development for the individual investor and family offices in terms of, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about what differences you see between institutional products and the private wealth products, but also are the institutional players going to come into the private space and still keep that same model that they use institutionally, or are they going to say, well, this is what the private wealth players do, so we'll kind of model after them?
You just asked a lot of questions there. So let me see if I can go through those slowly.
Start unpacking those. We can take them a chunk at a time.
There were so many things there.
But we can take them one at a time. So for instance, let's start with this. The institutional players are moving into the private space. Why? What's the big draw?
Well, they're moving in because they're looking at, from raising institutional money, which came from pension fund money is starting to dry up. By the way, at the end of the day, don't we all go to the same place, the individual? It's their money, whether it's in a pension fund or somewhere else. So at the end of the day, they're going more direct because pension fund money is starting to get slower. And so they're saying to themselves, why miss out in the retail environment if I can create something for the retail environment that makes sense? So that's one. Two...
Oh, go ahead.
Two, which is important here, is so now, why haven't they, right? It's been great. They should have been four. They didn't because when they looked at this, they were like, I don't understand how the investor can make money as well. And if you think about that, are they going to piss off the little old lady when they're ready with tons of pension fund money? No. So they're far, and they have track records to worry about, right? The biggest thing about being an institutional investor, right, is an institutional sponsor, is that at the end of the day, your track record is all you've worked for. And when you do a deal, every pension fund consultant is looking at you and checking on you and doing what I call the proctology exam to make sure that you've done and do the right thing. Right? It's not like three guys in a garage saying, let me go raise $1 billion. Right? right? You get the value of years and years of the proctology exam on these guys to make sure that they do the right thing in good times and in bad times. And you really want them to do the right thing, especially in bad times. So that institutional sponsor, somebody who's been in that marketplace, has extremes amount of value. And I always say, to me, I would rather have an A sponsor and a B opportunity than a B sponsor and an A opportunity. If you can make one decision as an investor, that sponsor doing the right and the wrong thing all the time is really the key to being a good investor.
Yeah, but wait a minute. What about in the private investment side? You have companies like Inland and Pasco and Shopoff. They have reputations that they have to protect. Why is that any different?
Well, I think some of them are pretty good. I don't think, I'm not saying all the guys out there have not done a good job. I think there's actually some good players in this sector.
So you're just talking about,
right?
Fly-by-nights. You don't see fly-by-nights in the institutional sector, but they're maybe, would you say, prevalent in the private sector? I mean, private wealth sector?
Well, you know, you got a lot of these companies starting here that say, I'm going to do $50 million private placements. You know, and you tell me there's three guys in a garage. You give me, and by the way, you pay the same fees for three guys in a garage as you do for an institutional investor. The fees didn't change. But, you know, when you start seeing these small deals of people that have never been in the institutional world raising money, I start to question, A, why, and B, why would you pay the same fees? Ever. You should pay for the services that you're given. So I struggle with that, and I think there is going to be a differentiation in this marketplace between the guys that are doing those kind of deals and the bigger guys in this world and the institutional guys who have reputations that they worry about every day.
So is it a good thing that the institutional players are moving into the space? It sounds like into the private wealth sector. It sounds like your answer would be yes.
I don't think it's good. I think it's great.
And what
I think it's great for investors.
What will the impact
be?
Will the ripple be beyond them?
Well, I do think there's going to be a split of what you see. There'll be some brokers that are going to sell high feed product from three guys in the garage, and there's going to be some guys that just sell institutional product where fees will be a little less, and you know, instead of paying the 12, you might pay 9 or 8 or whatever, and you'll get that value. Now, I will tell you, even the guys that have moved into this market so far in the institutional world, they're still mostly using a retail structure. So they're institutional who they are, but they're using a retail structure, which is you pay the fees. I think as this market develops, and you talk about product development, the key here is, can we bring institutional or institutional-like, real-like, not just use the term, sponsors, and institutional structures? And if we can, the person who's the beneficiary is the investor.
You know, I recently heard an industry player complain that, quote unquote, alternative investment products are dominated by real estate. It's like, where are the energy products? Where's the infrastructure products? Where are the innovative commodity products? What about farmland and agriculture? Do you agree that real estate is dominating the alternative and real asset space at the expense of other asset classes?
I do, actually. I think there's, and the reason is it's one of the few asset classes that has a, quote, consistent dividend, right? This market, to a large extent, has bought dividend. It buys yield. It hasn't really moved in the area where it's done a very good job of buying total return. So so a lot of the products you see are dividend-driven, right? And you know, part of the problem is, and we're very clear about this, I think a lot of people believe they're buying a lower volatility piece of paper. So they want their dividend, and they don't want that to change. So that limits the amount of products you're going to see here. I do believe if this is going to be a real market and really done right, if we can bring institutional product, it should be more diverse, and it shouldn't only be dividend-driven. It should be total return-driven. So, you know, I say to every investor, what's your best investing advice you can give me? And I always say to them, very simple, diversify. Diversify. Don't buy too much of anything, and get yourself a good diversified portfolio, because everything won't work out the way you wanted it to, and the things you never expected to work out so well sometimes work out better.
So when you look across the investment product platforms out there, What are some of the asset classes or flavors of asset classes that private wealth investors should have more access to? Or you may even know that they're clamoring for certain things that aren't really there in any real numbers or quality of product.
Right. Well, look, you got to create product that has a little lower volatility because investors don't really want it. And you got to create product that you can justify earning fees when they can't buy ETFs. So if you can buy an ETF to it, it probably makes no sense. So I do believe there are, look, I'm a macro player. I never believed I was that smart. I always believed if I get the macro trend right, I usually can't screw it up that badly. And if I get the macro trend wrong, there's not a lot you can do. So, you know, let's look at the macro trends. You know, healthcare, energy, they're not going anywhere. They're not going anywhere. Look at the things in this, you know, look at the products that aren't going anywhere. They're part of our economy, whether we like it or not, that have some yield, some will be better than others, and that have some total return. And so, you know, we're spending a lot of time trying to figure out where's the next place to go and how to create those products where it's something you can't buy with an ETF, and it's something that if we have the right management team, can outperform other people. And if we can do that, we'll have a pretty good reputation.
You know, I hear when I ask RIA CIOs and CEOs, what do you hear from your clients that they want more of? I hear very often, more than anything, infrastructure. Hard to access as an individual, especially in a illiquid form. Do you concur that infrastructure is an area that individual high net worth investors are looking for more of?
Yes, I do. And by the way, to date, at least, you know, the institutional infrastructure funds have done extremely well. So there's been great opportunity. But think about if you can get a product that might have some energy, some infrastructure to it, something that's a little more combined. So it kind of plays, you know, if you try to find where you can maximize value somewhere, but you can kind of worry about the downside risk if things turn the other way, right? So I think the ability to put together some of these funds, whether it be an interval fund or not, that have multiple plays with multiple institutional guys is something that the market can't get. And if you can create that well enough, you might get a play at a bunch of places that you couldn't buy as a stock or an option or an ETF.
So let me ask you this. We have this evolution going on where nowadays you don't even really need to be a high net worth individual to have access to investment products that you never had access to before. But the high net worth or ultra high net worth individual is usually fairly sophisticated. Your average run of the mill Joe who would like a diversified portfolio and access just to things like infrastructure and energy and whatnot, sometimes are very suspicious of the market. What do you think needs to happen to advance investor acceptance of new products, not just at that sophisticated level, the so-called accredited investors, but the average Joe on the street who's going to be comfortable with some of these new products that retail investors offer?
Well, I think it's education at the end of the day. Right? I mean, the hardest part for me is to explain to somebody what is the difference between an institutional sponsor and someone who's not, and the value of that. So I think it's purely education. Look, I love to speak and talk about this because I think if you can just get people, look, I'm not here to make people's decisions, but I want them to learn and to actually understand the questions they should ask. And if our products fit it, great. If they don't, I understand. But at the end of the day, if they ask the right questions, then they can make intelligent decisions. And hopefully one of them is, you know, who is the sponsor here? What is their track record? What have they done? Who are they? Why should I buy that? Right? And I think if you start to see that and people say, hey, listen, I might pay a little more, but I can buy the same product that other people are buying in the institutional world, I feel a little better. Right? The hardest thing is, and you know, you gotta avoid the bad stuff. And how do you do that? Pick the right sponsors. Look at their track record. Look at what they've done, good times and bad times. If you do that, you got a long way there.
So, broad, open-ended question. What is the future of product development, investment product development?
Well, I, I think I have some SEC laws I can't break right now. So the reality is, look, we're trying to, you know, we have a very simple game plan here. We're bringing institutional sponsors to this market, and we're trying to bring multiple products that kind of fit the client's needs. And mostly importantly, we try to keep our ears open for what people want and need, and we try to give them a fair shot at a good structure that actually makes it so they have a better shot of actually getting their money back and hopefully getting the return that they were promised.
Okay, our guest has been Steve Cantor. He's CEO of S2K Financial, and quite an animated and opinionated guy. We're talking about the future of product development, its weaknesses currently, where the market is headed. Steve, great podcast. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.